Members, the House Elections Committee will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, so we will not move the minutes, but we will as soon as we do. Members, today we have the good fortune to have what I sort of call the open mic hearing. I thought it was important, since this is a bipartisan committee, and since we all know that going back to Governor Pawlenty and then now Governor Dayton, the standard for elections bill is that it requires some bipartisan support. I think that's a good rule. And so I thought before we got into bills, which we will starting this coming Thursday in 2 days, I thought it was important to hear from some distinguished advocates from around Minnesota, from various ideological and political points of view about how they see Minnesota's election system and hear from them. Of course, members of the public, whether part of an interest group or not, are always welcome to testify in this in any committee. But I wanted to provide the opportunity for people to talk generally in a way that is untethered and unconnected to any specific proposal or specific bill and just get on the public record in a committee hearing setting about their priorities, things they want to see, things they don't want to see. Two other things, housekeeping items, members. Unfortunately, we're going to have an abbreviated, kind of truncated session today. Some of you may know at the last minute there was a meeting, pretty important meeting called for DFL members at 1:30 having to do with the governor and the budget. And so we're going to have to ask folks to stick to a 10-minute time frame. We might have just a little wiggle room, but I know that's shorter than you might have liked, but unfortunately that's kind of the way of the world around here. Second, and I say this not to insult anyone in the audience, I would say it no matter who was in the audience, we're going to hear from a wide range of views today. And there are people in the audience and elsewhere who will agree with some of the testifiers and some who will disagree. I think we've seen over the last few years that elections issues can be contentious. People have strong opinions about them. But I'm asking everyone in here to be respectful. And I'm gonna hold everyone in this room to a high standard. So I really don't want to hear sighing. I don't want to see, you know, the rolling of eyes or the tisk-tisk or the... there really isn't any place for that. And so I hope everyone, even and especially the people that you disagree with, is treated with the same respect. There will be time to rally your members and your constituents outside of this room, but I hope we can all be respectful. So with that, I want to call up to testify the first person in no particular order than in the order that it is on the list. I'd like to call up Dan McGrath, the president of Minnesota Majority, to give us his perspective. Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll let you say what you want to say for approximately 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan McGrath, president of Minnesota Majority. For those of you who are familiar with my work, you'll know that our organization has been researching the integrity of Minnesota's election system for the past 5 years now. Our research in the past has led to a record number of convictions for voter fraud following the 2008 election, a record not only for the state of Minnesota, but the highest number of convictions that any state in the country has seen from a single election since 1936. That high conviction rate is not because our election system was so quick and efficient that it caught it. In fact, it missed it. Without our independent research, the vast majority of those fraudulent votes would never have been detected and prosecuted. Although 200 people were convicted, we have conclusive proof that over 1,000 people voted fraudulently in the 2008 election. So our election system has some flaws. It's got some holes in it. It's definitely got room for improvement. Now, there are some good things about Minnesota's election system. High turnout, our tradition of civic participation, engaged voters are things that we can all be proud of as Minnesotans. Our combination of paper ballots and optical scanners creates kind of a best of both worlds situation where we can get rapid tabulation of election results with the optical scanners, but because it's not electronic voting, we still have a paper trail that's verifiable through recounts should the need arise. So that can give us confidence in our ballot counts. But the problems kind of come in before the ballot is put into the optical scanners. Our combination of election day registration and vouching create an environment where an unscrupulous voter can create an identity from whole cloth, doesn't have to be tied to any real person. You just make up a name on the spot, give an address, and you're going to be given a ballot. Now, after the fact, postcards are mailed out to verify the address of newly registered voters. After the 2008 election, we saw 6,000 election day registrants flagged for challenge after they voted because their postcard came back as undeliverable mail. I personally drove around, took photographs of some of the properties that were listed as voter registration addresses, and I found warehouses and swamps, forests, sections of freeways, parks, areas that were completely non-residential, in fact, where there wasn't a house for miles around in some cases. So that's pretty strong evidence that we have a problem with vouching fraud. There is no real serious effort right now in our election system to detect or prevent or prosecute voter fraud. It's taken outside citizens groups twisting arms of county attorneys to get them to actually investigate and prosecute. We've got some other problems. In the 2010 election, we saw a situation in Crow Wing County where mentally incapacitated individuals that were under guardianship orders that were specific that they did not have the right to vote were brought to vote by their caregivers. And the eyewitness report from Crow Wing County Courthouse, they were brought to vote early, voting by absentee ballot. The caregivers were actually filling out the ballots for the people that were in their care, while the people that were in their care were wandering off, not even anywhere near the ballot booth, or the voting booth. So, with all of these things in mind, I think it's important when we address election reforms that we balance access. I know there's been a lot of discussion about bringing about some kind of early voting to make it easier for people to vote, or no excuse absentee ballots, and you know there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but at the same time that we're focusing on the need for access, we have to balance that with the need for greater integrity in our system. So during the voter ID campaign last year for the voter ID amendment, I heard all the time from the opposition, send it back to get it right. Now, the people that voted no on the amendment may have done so under the impression that this is better done through legislation, not so much that they disagree with voter ID, but maybe it doesn't belong in the Constitution, and they may have bought that notion, send it back to get it right. So I think when the voters said send it back to get it right, they didn't intend that we loosen up the system even more, or rather I think they expected that this legislature would do something to improve the integrity of our election system. The proposal that Secretary of State brought forth, Secretary of State Mark Ritchie brought forth last year for electronic poll books coupled with a photograph, I don't believe is the gold standard of identifying voters, but it's better than what we're doing now. So if we can make that progress, I would strongly recommend that we implement poll books, use the photographic technology as the Secretary of State proposed, as a step in the right direction. The poll books will also increase efficiency, increase accuracy. It will prevent common data entry errors. It will allow us to update our election records on a much faster basis. Right now, it can take up to 6 months before we know who voted in the election. Poll books will make it instantaneous. They're going to save the counties tons of money in hiring temp workers to do data entry. So Minnesota Majority strongly recommends them. It seems as though it's nearly universal that poll books are a good idea, and we should try them here in Minnesota. They've already been successfully used in Minnetonka for years. The election officials there absolutely love electronic poll books. On the subject of early voting, if there's an imperative that we must do something for early voting, I would recommend rather than the actual early voting where people are having ballots tabulated instantly in an optical scanner, that instead we go with a no-excuse absentee ballot option so that if circumstances change before the election, voters can change their mind, recast a ballot, which isn't possible with early voting, and to increase the integrity of the process. The early voting precludes citizen oversight, which has been a key part of Minnesota's election system since the beginning. Partisan challengers present in the polling place overseeing the election gives us confidence that there aren't shenanigans going on in the polling place, or it helps give us some confidence anyway. With early voting, it's simply not possible to have 4,000 partisan challengers deployed across the state from each political party for weeks on end. It can't be done. So it sounds to me like this probably isn't going anywhere, but I had heard a proposal to allow felons to vote in Minnesota as a solution for the voter fraud that was detected before, but that's kind of like when the Department of Transportation found that something like 70% of our highways were congested. Well, they just fixed the problem by redefining what congested meant, but the congestion was still just the same. So letting felons vote isn't really a solution. I believe it would require an amendment to the Constitution to make that happen, And I think that a lot of the victims' advocacy groups would have some issues with allowing murderers and rapists and people that are showing a total disregard for our laws participating in the process of making the laws that they're flaunting. So with that, I'd like you to keep in mind, send it back to get it right, let's get it right. Let's not simply focus on access, but let's do something for integrity as well. Thank you. With that, I'll take any questions the members may have.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. If there are no urgent questions, I'd prefer, because we only have an hour in this hearing instead of an hour and a half, to hear from all the testifiers, and then if we have time at the end, give folks on the committee a chance to ask a question. Thanks, Mr. McGrath. Let's go to the next person, Jerry Frank, Chair of Common Cause Minnesota. Thanks very much, Mr. Frank. If you will introduce yourself for the record and then just proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Frank. I'm the Chair of Common Cause Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity you provided for Common Cause to speak before you today. My testimony will cover three areas of concern: election reform, campaign finance reform, and lobbying reform. After a year in which Minnesotans defeated a proposed constitutional amendment that would have unfairly threatened the rights of thousands to cast their votes, we believe it is time to expand the right to vote and bring more people into the political system. We support no-excuse absentee balloting and early voting, and believe that offering a longer window for voting can help reduce the pressures on the system on election day, resulting in a smoother, more manageable experience for voters and election officials. Other worthy concepts are online registration and automatic registration when getting a driver's license, for example. These would save money for local governments and would help maintain accuracy by tracking name and address changes. The Citizens United decision has created an environment of anything goes in our campaigns and has greatly undermined confidence in our election and in our political process. Our state law requiring better disclosure of these new independent expenditures under Citizens United was challenged in court last year because of its requirement for political groups to register with the state during periods in which they had no real money spent on political activity. A priority for 2013 should be to address this issue and come up with disclosure requirements that protect the public interest, are enforceable, and pass judicial scrutiny. Additional steps to neutralize Citizens United, for example, shareholder approval, limiting corporations with significant foreign ownership, and large government contracts should also be considered. Stronger disclosure of private interests trying to influence public policy and public officials is needed in several other areas. In particular, we would support stronger statements of economic interest. This could help legislators determine if a conflict of interest existed. We would also support the campaign finance and public disclosure board's proposed electioneering communication requirements, where, like the federal law, if it looks like a campaign ad, it is a campaign ad. In addition, we would encourage disclosure of money spent on issue ads and disclosure of what is in a bill. A legislator should get 72 hours to read a bill. Also, the public should have access to legislators' calendar. Other campaign financing related issues that we support would be additional funding for the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board and restoring the political contribution refund. The Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board has been severely underfunded for the last decade, making it unable to adequately enforce the laws on the books and hold lobbyists and politicians accountable. The executive director of the board, Gary Goldsmith, recently said, "There are compliance issues that we know of in the lobbyist program that we still cannot review and enforce because we don't have the staff to do it. Still, tighter lobbyist requirements are needed. Currently, you can be an employed lobbyist, have many meetings with legislators, and testify at many committees, and not have to register. As shown in the recent documentary film, The United States of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council has wield extraordinary power in state capitals by providing model legislation, everything from gun control to environmental policy to tax policy and to proposing the privatization of essential social services. ALEC counts among its members some 2,000 state legislators and corporate executives. they sit side by side and collaborate to draft model bills that reach into many areas of American life. They work in concert to get those bills passed in state houses across the country. Common Cause strongly supports strengthening our lobbying laws to require better disclosure of Alex's activities and to better reflect the fact that this organization is engaged in lobbying. Holding questions?
Thank you very much. I think we'll hold off for now, Mr. Frank. Really appreciate it. Before we go on, one housekeeping item, Representative Sanders. I don't know if you've had a chance to review the minutes, and if so, would you care to move approval?
I have, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Okay. Representative Sanders moves approval of the minutes. All in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The minutes are approved. We'll go on to the next testifier, Deanna Strauss, who's a board member of the Minnesota Voters Alliance. Thank you, Ms. Strauss. If you could just first introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Deanna Strauss, and I'm with the Minnesota Voters Alliance. I'd just like to briefly describe the two topics that we have been working on. One is the duty of the state to confirm the eligibility of each voter prior to giving them a ballot. And the second one is just the need for some common sense improvements on involving the statewide registration voter system database. In February of 2012, the Minnesota Voters Alliance filed a lawsuit asking that they find Article 7, Section 1 of the Minnesota Constitution requires that the state confirm eligibility of voters prior to granting them ballots. We have cited that the plain article in Article 7, Section 1, it reads as follows. The following persons shall not be entitled or permitted to vote in any election in this state if a person is not meeting the above requirements. The person being convicted of treason or felony, unless restored to civil rights. A person under guardianship, or a person who is not mentally competent. These above requirements are referred to for ones of age, citizen, and residence. The heart of our claim now before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, Section 1 demands that it is equally as important to make sure that the ineligible persons do not vote as to be ensure that every eligible person does have the right to do so. The meaning of Article 7, Section 1 has clearly stated by Judge Jay Quam, the presiding judge in Hennepin County Probate Court, in recent order, the court's obligation to the electoral process is twofold. Courts must ensure that every citizen entitled to vote is allowed to do so. Anything less deprives that citizen of the fundamental right, and it deprives the citizenry of a true democracy. Also, the courts do ensure that no person who is not entitled to vote to not do that. Anything else dilutes the fundamental rights of the proper electorate and equally and otherwise deprives citizenship of true democracy. Now, we do expect to set a hearing for those oral arguments in court. Our position is simple, that the state must use the information in its database to confirm the eligibility of every person who registers to vote, either prior to or on election day, before allowing them to cast ballots. Secretary of State Ritchie has presented to the court with an equally simple but diametrically opposable position, namely that his office has no duty to confirm the voters' eligibility but no authority to do so before granting them access to the ballot box. We have presented the court with the data obtained from the Secretary of State's office itself, showing that more than 48,000 individuals who have registered and voted on Election Day in 2008 have never been confirmed as eligible. Even after the election, that 48,000 voters whose eligibility to vote was never verified in the election, which still many important races were determined by that scant margin by a few hundred votes or less. Now, we would urge anyone interested in these details of our arguments to go to our website, www.mnvoters.org, to see the findings. But here's our suggestion today. We ask that the members of the committee to inform themselves about this position taken by the state in this lawsuit, and then inform their constituencies to whether they agree with the secretary or not. Further, we urge that any changes to the election statutes that you construct during these proceedings include with clarity that the state must verify every voter eligibility prior to that person voting. If, on the other hand, the legislature's collective judgment is that the state may assume each registrant is eligible and allow him or her to vote without confirming that person's constitution eligibility, then your charges to the election statute should be made clear. This issue is a fundamental one, and it underlies any changes to the laws that you make, and it underlies the confidence of the citizenry in the validity of our election results. For the basis of our election system is that anyone may vote simply upon their say-so that should be known to the people, or the legislature is operating under the view that every voter should be confirmed by the state to be eligible before they are allowed to vote. That's the principle provides a test to which all provisions of our election laws should be subject. The Minnesota Voters Alliance would like to make three suggestions involving the statewide voter registration database. One is transparency. It is necessary to define precisely what data can be made available to the public, and those data should be the same data as required on the public CD, which can be bought for $46 from the state, namely with name, address, year of birth, voter ID, and so forth. But the CD should include more. Most important, records for persons who are the status is not active, or should be available to the public. Currently, only persons with the active status are released. The public data should include those marked inactive, challenged, deceased, or deleted. Also, a full set of data fields should be released to include those such as registration date, registration method, the details of the postal verification processing. The availability of the public and these data would allow substantially increased analysis for the registration database by academics, political analysts, candidates, and the media, and interested individuals who would not infringe on our privacy of the listed individuals because the personal data items would be the same as what they are currently being released right now. The second one is vouching. Currently, there is no record in the SVRS of vouching. We suggest that the registration database both record the person who was vouched for and the person who did the vouching. These vouching records would be public information. Third is identification. It would be useful to explicitly list the registration database, whether the person has submitted the ID or not. What type of ID was used, such as a driver's license, social security number, military or student ID, or so forth. That actual ID number would not be released, just the type of ID employed by the individual to register. The availability of this information would enable better public knowledge of the use of IDs by voters and the degree in which the registrants are not proven. Finally, I would just like to emphasize, along with making the vote as simple as easy as possible, we must simultaneously ensure that each person who takes advantage of their voting right does not have their franchise offset or diluted by the vote of an ineligible person. So with regard to the lawsuit, you can also refer to Eric Cardall. He's been taking this on. Like I said, we'd like to email a copy of this to Jim Geldman, so if anybody is interested in reading this further, they can do so at that time. Is there any questions?
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. The next testifiers, we have a duo here, Laura Frederick Wang and Sherry Knuth, both of the League of Women Voters Minnesota. They'll come down. Just introduce yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony. About 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. My name is Laura Frederick Wang, and I am the Executive Director of the League of Women Voters Minnesota, and with me today is Sherry Knuth, LWV Minnesota's Public Policy and Outreach Manager. I would like to take a few moments to tell you just a little bit about our organization. LWV Minnesota will be marking our 94th anniversary this year of ensuring that every voter's right to vote is protected. Today, we have over 39 local units and communities across Minnesota, with membership in greater Minnesota, the suburbs, and inner city neighborhoods. In addition to the work that we do here at our state capitol, our members also produce voter guides, host and moderate hundreds of candidate forums and debates across the state. We register voters and answer questions from voters about elections. In the days leading up to the 2012 election, our office ran a hotline that took calls from voters who had a wide variety of questions about elections. Well, most of those calls were simple things, things like finding out where somebody voted, where their polling place was, telling them what they needed to bring to register for same-day registration. Many questions were much more complicated and reflected the complexity of people's day-to-day situations. This included people with unexpected family or work commitments who learned at the last minute that they were not going to be in town on election day, people who were unsure if their civil right had been restored after a long-ago criminal conviction, people in transitional housing situations without a permanent address, and many people with no housing at all who were wondering whether or not they could still vote and how. These experiences helped to inform the proposals that we will be supporting at the legislature this year. Minnesota has a great election system, and we often hear from election administrators, as well as our fellow league members all across the country, that Minnesota is well respected for how we run elections and the way that we strike the right balance between both integrity and access. However, we also believe that there are reforms that have been adopted in other parts of the country that have proven to be successful in both improving the voters' experience while still protecting that integrity. With your permission, I would like to turn it over to Sherry Knuth right now to outline some of those reforms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Our priorities for the 2013 legislative session are protecting and improving voting rights and Minnesota's election system. We support modernizing access to the ballot box through online voter registration, early voting, and no-excuse absentee voting. These measures would help keep our election system equally accessible to all citizens. Online registration would supplement current methods of registration, which involve filling out a form by hand, either prior to an election or at the polls. The committee heard statements last week from election administrators and election judges that online voter registration would ease lines in the polling place because more citizens would be able to register prior to election day, thus reducing the number of election day registrants. Online registration would also provide greater ease in registering for the voters themselves. Many citizens now conduct all of their day-to-day transactions online. Many citizens would benefit from being able to register online, including busy working parents and citizens with mobility issues. Early voting also provides greater access for voters in all walks of life. Last week, election administrators and judges spoke about how early voting reduces administrative requirements when compared to the absentee ballot process. Early voting also reduces congestion at the polls on election day. These are important considerations. From the perspective of League of Women Voters, early voting is also a benefit because it provides greater flexibility to citizens regarding when they are able to cast their ballots. In addition, it allows a voter to fill out a ballot and see it deposited directly in the ballot box, something that does not happen with the complexities of absentee balloting.
Finally, with regard to campaign finance, the League of Women Voters supports measures that ensure the public's right to know who is trying to influence their vote. We believe that funding for the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board should be increased to allow it to do its work in a manner envisioned by the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Act. We look forward to hearing the legislative changes that the board indicated that they will submit the session to strengthen some aspects of Minnesota's campaign finance law. Finally, we'd like to thank you for your commitment to our elections and for your time this morning.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. We have one more testifier. Last but not least, I'd like to welcome Annette Meeks from the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota to offer her perspective. Ms. Meeks, if you could just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Annette Meeks, and I am here as a private citizen. In my real life, I am CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. We're a research organization. We don't lobby, but I have spent a significant amount of time, as I joke with the chairman recently, on just about every task force that's been created in the last 10 years on a bipartisan basis to discuss political and electoral reform in Minnesota. So I come here today to bring you a very brief snapshot of some of those suggestions that have been made through the years. The three overriding or four overriding principles that we've always considered are building more confidence in our system, ensuring timely, complete public disclosure in our campaign process, leveling the playing field for all participants, and encouraging a better informed electorate. I think we can all agree on those. The goal is how we get there. And I think first and foremost, what I would like to propose is moving our primary. I have been testifying about this as a private citizen now for 10 years, and the only thing we all agreed on a bipartisan basis 10 years ago was the only thing worse than a September primary was an August primary. And I think we saw this last year exactly what we meant by that. It was called 9% turnout. Our primary election, by the way, is supposed to be a party election where the party faithful officially nominate their candidates. It's not a mini general election. And we seem to lose sight of that fact when we have a primary election that is so far in distance and in time from the party nominating process. A primary is supposed to reinforce the party endorsement process by making them the official party nominee, allowing them to then go forward into the general election and campaign. Currently, only 11 states have a later primary. Two-thirds of all states select their nominees earlier than Minnesota. So we really put all of our candidates at a distinct disadvantage by having such a late primary. The other question I hear quite a bit is, well, that just encourages self-financing candidates to come forward and defeat, especially legislators, with all due respect, who are oftentimes caught in the legislative session until late May. And again, I'd like to refute this fallacy. Just looking at the 2012 elections, Mr. Chairman, let me give you a few examples of candidates that defeated better funded challengers and incumbents. For example, Tommy Thompson in our neighboring state of Wisconsin defeated two other very well-financed candidates, including a candidate by the name of Eric Hovde, who spent, and I quote, his personal fortune trying to win the Senate nomination. He was unsuccessful. The 2012 Florida primary, 12-term Congressman Cliff Stearns never had won re-election, 12 terms, with less than 59% of the vote, however, was defeated in his primary by Ted Yoho, who is now the congressman, an unknown and unfunded candidate. Indiana, 2012 U.S. Senate primary, 7-term U.S. Senator Dick Lugar, raised and outspent, and I quote, significantly more than Mark Murdoch, who also won the primary. Arizona 2012 U.S. Senate primary, Representative Jeff Flake defeated wealthy businessman Will Cardin. Cardin spent $6 million of his own money and still was unsuccessful. There are many, many more examples. But in this case, having an earlier primary was not the determining factor if you had more money or if you were the challenger. An earlier primary just meant they resolved their differences earlier than we did in Minnesota. Money, incumbency, everything, it's really who is the better candidate that oftentimes prevails. And frankly, one of the candidates who lost said, really, candidates who lose touch with constituents back home tend to attract opposition regardless of when the primary election occurs. And I thought that was a very interesting statement. The other thing that I think that Minnesota would be very well served and our voters would be is restricting party ballot access so that if you have an R or a DFL behind your name, that you have been granted that right by the political party. What we have right now is an ability for sometimes people who don't even live in this country to come slap a party identification label behind their name, run in a party primary, and confuse voters as to who has the party nomination. Many states solve this problem by restricting access to the parties by having multiple party endorsements where that entitles you to that line on the ballot, but it doesn't allow other people to file as a member of that political party. They file then as an independent and have their own separate primary. This allows political parties to control who has access to that line item on the ballot, and also provides a greater strength to parties in encouraging candidates to go before them. It also eliminates the winner-take-all endorsement process. And finally, Mr. Chairman, the one thing I feel so very strongly about, and I think many people would agree with me, is we need a real presidential primary in Minnesota, please. 18 states hold presidential primaries before their state primary elections, so we could accomplish both. 20 states hold them concurrently, so we could do either one. With an earlier primary, we could still have a real presidential primary election. Why? Number one, it garners presidential attention to our state. I don't think there's anyone who could dispute the fact that Iowa, New Hampshire, Michigan, South Carolina pick the state, but we all know a heck of a lot more about them, and I guarantee you the eventual nominees of each party knows a lot more about those states and those voters and their industries and their challenges than they do about Minnesota. But imagine if we had an earlier presidential primary, a real presidential primary, not what we have right now where you get a post-it note handed out by a volunteer at your precinct caucus that means nothing. If we had a real presidential primary, imagine we could have a presidential debate on health care reform in Rochester, or we could have a higher ed debate at the U of M right here in the Twin Cities. We would garner that attention that we currently don't get. We have a process that is virtually meaningless with non-binding candidates, and frankly, it's extremely difficult to encourage young people to get out and do it after they've done it once. And finally, I hope that there is some bipartisan agreement on campaign finance reform. I've not heard anybody speak about this, so I'll throw in my 2 cents worth in what time I have remaining. And that is, we really need to look seriously at what we consider a major giver in Minnesota and raise the contribution limits for statewide candidates in Minnesota. And heck, I'll even throw in the legislature, too. It seems preposterous to me that you can run a U.S. Senate race in Minnesota with a contribution limit of $2,500 per person and then turn around and say, but if you're running statewide for Secretary of State, Auditor, Attorney General, your contribution, $200. It's 10%, and you're buying the same media, contacting the same voters, needing to reach all of those same voters that the other candidates are, and we give them a very significant insignificant amount that they can collect from their supporters or stockholders, as I like to think of them. And as a requirement then for raising those, then perhaps we can require more immediate or more comprehensive disclosure. But I do think that's something we need to modernize. I've thought that for quite some time and just couldn't resist the opportunity to throw that in, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Ms. Meeks. I appreciate it. Members, I think now is the time that we can entertain questions, not only for Ms. Meeks, but for any of the testifiers who have gone before. I do want to just say a quick word about the groups that were here testifying. I had been asked by some other groups to testify that were less sort of umbrella organizations. I was more personally interested in hearing from groups that generally dealt with election or campaign finance issues. And so there are other groups that have maybe a single issue pertaining to the election system or campaign finance that wanted to testify. And I really thought that that was probably not the better use of our time because they would be focusing on only one issue. That doesn't mean they're not legitimate and they don't have things to say that the committee members wouldn't be interested in. So if you're wondering why we haven't heard from some of those groups, that's why. So I'd like to turn it over now to members, and feel free to call on others to come down. I know it's a little awkward, but I wanted to make sure everyone got their say in before we peppered them with questions and that we didn't want to cut anyone off. We have 20 minutes left, and I'll turn now to Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Meeks. First question is for you. Are you proposing that we do away with the caucus system in Minnesota in lieu of the primary? And if you are not suggesting that, why not?
Ms. Meeks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I have my own personal thoughts on that and would probably encourage a hybrid system. I think one thing we're looking at in Minnesota, and I say this as a longtime party activist, longtime party official, and heck, even a candidate, I think our system has gotten too small. and does not encourage greater participation, and I really believe it does not encourage greater participation amongst young women and women with families in particular. I think it's very difficult for someone to participate in our political process as it currently exists with young children and give up a whole host. I always say you give up a month of Saturdays if you're a Republican in Minnesota and want to hang in there and go all the way to the state convention. That's a tremendous sacrifice. So I guess from my own personal selfish standpoint, I would like to see the system enlarged so that more people can participate. I think that's why an earlier primary benefits more people. They'll see, oh, before the kids are out of school, before everybody starts on their summer vacations, I'm going to go vote, we're going to pick a party nominee, and off we go. And they have all summer to campaign rather than delaying the party process even further, as we do right now into August, so that we continue that party bickering all summer long without a nominee.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, should we have a caucus system or not?
Ms. Meeks.
Mr. Chairman, I think you can have both. I think you can still have a caucus system, and I think the caucus system works extremely well for having a full debate of issues. I'm not sure the caucus system serves us well in selecting candidates anymore, and frankly, getting the best candidates to come forward and participate in that system, because it's become very, very difficult, very time-consuming, and very expensive.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I should maybe narrow this just a little bit more. What I'm getting at is, should the caucus system then lead to convention endorsements, and then you know the system now, the primary follows that to essentially ratify or not the convention endorsement?
Ms. Meeks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, if I had my druthers and could design a perfect system, I think it would be a hybrid, where the caucus system would still produce, for example, in the Republican Party, the way it works is the local party unit that would have jurisdiction over the legislature, for example, is obligated to nominate. In other words, a state convention cannot nominate somebody for the legislature. I think it would be ideal if we could have multiple endorsements, where it's like a good housekeeping seal of approval that says, here's the Republican Party believes that Representative Erdahl, and he got 60%, well, then he's the only one who's going to appear on the ballot in your legislative district. However, on a statewide basis, they might have four candidates that come forward for endorsement, and they might look at that and say, you know, two of these are really outstanding candidates, so we're going to endorse two of them and put them forward on a primary ballot with Republican behind their names. But other people who come forward and just slap an R behind their names, perhaps by paying a filing fee and living in a foreign country, would not be able to screw up that party nomination process. They would run as an independent. And so the party would still maintain some control over that R and endorsed on the ballot, and keep troublemakers from coming into the primary election and causing that trouble. But it would also allow us to put forward a greater selection of candidates to the general election voter, if you will, that votes in that primary, that's not a party player, if you will.
Thank you. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have more of a comment to both Dan McGrath and Deanna Strauss regarding guardianship. Maybe we need to have a discussion around voting and guardianship, but we need to start with some basic understandings. And one of them is simply, as I learned from Representative Susan Allen, who is of Native American ancestry, that when the Constitution in Minnesota was formed in 1856, that the people that they meant by those under guardianship were American Indians, because all of the Native people were under guardianship at that point. They could not vote. And we didn't at that time have the people under guardianship that we have now under health system. So it was really a way of preventing the Natives from voting. And we have to take that into consideration as to what is meant by that in the Constitution. And that's why we have people under guardianship able to vote in the state of Minnesota under our court system having decreed this, except for those who a judge has said cannot. And if I remember correctly from judiciary last session, that's only a few dozen people. So to say that, as Dan McGrath said, that he saw many people there who were under guardianship and were misrepresented in the voting process. They shouldn't have been voting. There's only a few dozen people in the entire state of Minnesota who have lost their right to vote because they're under guardianship. That is not several hundred.
Any other members with questions pending? I have a question, or really a comment. I'm interested, Mr. Frank, just if you could come down for a second. Is he still here? There he is. As you're coming down, I think, members, one issue that we're going to be grappling with this session, I think, and I think there's a bipartisan appetite, I suspect, for it, having talked with colleagues here on the committee, is to do something in the area of disclosure reform. I think there's an acknowledgement that Minnesota could be doing better and providing the public with some more information. But as I see it, anyway, it's about striking the right balance. For example, there's been some talk recently in the past few months about what we do about those of us in the legislature who work for clients, whether we're attorneys, consultants, independent contractors. How much information is enough and how much is too much? I suppose at one end of the spectrum would be requiring legislators who do that kind of work to just release a client list, an actual list of clients. But there you get into the problem, at least from my vantage point, and maybe this is my own sort of occupational bubble. As an attorney, sometimes you get into attorney-client privilege issues. So I can easily imagine a situation where a criminal defense attorney, for example, and I'm not one, but if I were, somebody might come into my office and might say, I want to retain you. I am under investigation by the FBI, or my business is under investigation by the FBI. I want to retain you, but it's very important that no one know that I've lawyered up. Because if they knew that, not only would my reputation be in peril, but my company's stock price would plummet or something like that. And so there are attorney-client privilege issues there. I'm wondering whether you've given any thought to, either officially or formally at Common Cause, or you individually, as to how far we should go. Is the answer maybe something in between, like people who provide services checking a box by category? One idea I've heard is that you could have independent contractors, consultants, attorneys check a box saying, okay, I do work for the agricultural sector or the nonprofit sector or the educational sector without listing clients. Do you have any view on that?
Well, as far as the attorney-client privileges, I think we have to accept that. That would be have to be part of the law. I think that the other than attorney-client, I'm not sure I've heard of any other examples that where it would be the same thing as far as not disclosing. I think otherwise the disclosure, the categories often don't work very well. I mean, as far as really telling somebody if there's a conflict of interest, you know, it's hard to make them specific enough to be able to make that decision.
So, Mr. Frank, so if you had your way, it would be a list of clients that people who provide services for clients would disclose in public, the list of their clients.
Yes,
is
it
that
would.
Correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it would.
Okay. I mean, I just think that's an issue, members, that we're going to be grappling with this session and trying to figure out what the right balance there is. I know other states have done various things. I understand that in California there's a dollar threshold, that if you get a certain amount of money from a certain client, then you have to report that client, whether you're a consultant or independent contractor or attorney. If it's below that, you don't. I'm not quite sure what the answer is, but I think this committee will be grappling with what the best thing is to do, and as always, we're going to have to do it on a bipartisan basis. So I was interested in your testimony generally on the disclosure issue. Mr. Frank?
Mr. Chairman, a dollar threshold would also be legitimate, I think.
Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Frank is there. I have a question for him.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The phrase has been brought up earlier today, and I'm sure that members of the committee are interested, including the chairman, this phrase that I don't know if Common Cause specifically used it, but those who supported your position in the last election did, send it back and fix it. What suggestions would you have for fixing photo ID?
Well, I think one of the things that we were critical of was that the difference between the amendment and the law. I mean, there was a lot of unanswered questions, and so things were just not very clear. It's kind of like we weren't sure what we were getting. Right, so I think we would certainly accept that the fact that if something like that were to pass, it needs to be much more clear. in many parts of the bill. Did I answer your question?
Representative Erdahl.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Frank, so you were saying that there would be a photo ID provision that you could support.
Mr. McGrath and I, prior to coming in here, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we talked about the poll book, which I assume would handle many of the desires of Mr. McGrath's organization. And that seems like a legitimate thing to consider.
Okay. And members, just on that point about poll books, which to my mind anyway is an area of potential common ground and bipartisan action here. The way I see it, and I know Representative Sanders had to step out here, but he and I had a conversation about this too, and I'd be interested either on the record or offline in individual members' thoughts about this, but and Representative Halverson, our Vice Chair, and I have talked about it too, which is there are, to my mind anyway, a lot of moving parts when it comes to poll books, and we may at some point have to delegate a group of us, and I'm not talking about a formal subcommittee, we don't need more architecture and structure like that around here, but just an informal group that can convene and come up with some of the principles. For example, there are various ways that we can use poll books. We can use them as the City of Minnetonka does, as I think Mr. McGrath mentioned in his testimony, or someone did. They use it just for same-day voter registration. So they don't use it at all for the photo piece. They just use it for same-day. And as Mr. McGrath did testify to, jurisdictions that don't use any such technology end up taking weeks and weeks, to, like Hennepin County, to hand-enter the same-day registration information. And now, weeks later, we still don't know all the information about same-day registration in Hennepin County because temps are hired, I'm led to believe, and that is hand-inputted. Another thing we could do that has not been done in Minnesota yet is use it for photos, as Representative Erdahl alludes to, where we would have preloaded photos. But in talking with some of the vendors, there are a lot of decisions that would have to be made. And rather than just put a bill out there and have a free-for-all on this committee, I think it might be good for some interested members of this committee, divided, of course, equally on a partisan basis, to discuss that issue. So I don't know, Mr. Frank, I'm putting you on the spot here, but do you have any views on to what use we could put poll books? Are you suggesting that we could use them both for same-day voter registration and for the photo component?
I think that's a possibility. It has also the benefit of updating, you know, addresses, name changes, and things like that. And you could, you could also take photos at that on voting day. They would go into the system for the next cycle.
Okay. I mean, it just seems to me, members, that technology could really help with some of these conflicts. I mean, it has the potential anyway, the electronic poll book, to provide some of the verification that some folks want without imposing the burdens that other folks are concerned with. So a voter, theoretically anyway, would walk into a polling place, would have to show nothing, would have to state their name, and the photo, at least ideally, as it's conceived, the photo would already be preloaded. If that person had a driver's license or state ID, their photo would already be there. So the person need not bring anything to the polls, but their photo would be there if they don't have a state identification, either because they just have never had one or they just moved here from Arkansas, then their photo could be taken on the spot right there. That's at least the theoretical idea, and it seems to me, at least conceptually, that could satisfy, never completely, I'm sure, but could satisfy both camps, those who don't want burdens imposed on voters, but those who do want an extra level of verification. But I'm not naive, I hope not, there are a lot of moving parts to this kind of provision, and just the technical aspects of it alone might merit some side group or subgroup of this committee, and we can talk about that offline as well. Any questions from committee members? We have about 5 minutes left of the shortened hearing. Any other questions or comments from committee members about any issue we've discussed or to any testifier today that we've heard from? Nobody? Okay. Well, we're actually done with our short hearing, 5 minutes early. This was a good opportunity, I hope, to hear from some of the preeminent organizations in our state who deal regularly with elections and individuals as well about their views on these issues. We will start hearing bills, finally, in this next committee hearing. We're going to hear Representative Norton's bill on the situation of vacancies on the ballot due to death or resignation in the nonpartisan context, and that will be a springboard to a discussion of how to handle that in the partisan context. So we will have Representative Norton's bill on Thursday, and with that, the committee is adjourned.